Yeah.
Here we go.
Good morning. This is already February 3rd. I think we made it past Groundhog's Day, 2016. And this is the Subcommittee on Education. Welcome, all of you. Today, we have an informational hearing, and I will open that after we get some updates from our wonderful staff, Mr. Wilson. And so we're going to start out with Doug.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real briefly, Julie is back from last session, will be with us this month. In terms of meetings, we have room for, I think, seven meetings. We do not have a great number of items to deal with, and there may be a chance that we won't meet all seven times. We will reserve the last couple meetings for any policy bills that may come this way. I don't think there are too many in the policy committee. Senator Roveland may know better than I do, but I'm not sure how many will come down here. In terms of process, nothing new, but if you are going to be late, significantly late, or not able to attend the meeting, please get hold of either myself or Julie would probably be the best way to do it. Or the one of the committee sub-chairs, but staff would just please make sure staff knows too. An email in the morning will work for that. Keep in mind that meeting materials are all on OLIS. We will not be bringing any written copies, trying to keep what the rest of the committees are doing in the building. The rules are the same as last year with one exception that had some discussion of full committee. That is that the subcommittee can open an informational hearing if there's not a quorum present. Of course, they can't take any formal action, and the purpose of that is if there is a full agenda, they can get started. We've been doing for years with the sort of the term subcommittee of a subcommittee, which really isn't exist, but that just formalizes something that's been going on for quite a while, and the intent is just to, if it's a full agenda, keep things moving. Other than that, everything else is pretty much the same. If we get to policy bills, the amendments will be filed separately under the amendments category or designation in OLIS. It's a little different than I think we've done in this subcommittee, where we've tried to put sort of packets together. That's in keeping in line with the policy committees are doing. And in terms of any funding items that will be heard here, they will not be sent to full committee. They'll be sent as a recommendation to include in the major funding bill, or what's sometimes called the reconciliation bill, and then that will go through capital construction at the end of the session or near the end, and then to full committee. Any reports, grants, things like that are formally requested will be going to full committee, just like they do during the interim from either Ways and or interim Ways and Means or the e-board. So like today, one of these is a formal report, the first agenda item on long-term care and treatment. The second is one that the subcommittee requested the Department of Education to come back and talk about online charter schools and charter school or online programs in general. So with that, Madam Chair, that's all I have.
Well, thank you, Doug. Any questions for members? Okay. Third day of session. It feels like we've been off and rolling for a week and a half already, and so we might as well keep moving at that pace. So I'm going to open an informational hearing about long-term care and treatment program. Please come forward, Rick and Mitch, and get us up to date.
Madam Chair, just to open this,
thank you, Doug.
This is a report that was required by budget note in the ODE's major funding bill 5016 from last session. They'll describe what the program is, but there was a new rate schedule based on a minimum standard that was placed through the budget note. Also, in the budget note, required them to come back. I will also say there's a funding issue that they'll briefly talk about, but that will not be part of today's report or any action on the funding gap. that will be dealt with in the reconciliation bill in the full committee.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Comp. Good morning, Senator Moreau, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Prager. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for Finance Administration for the Department of Education. With me here today is Mitch Kreska. He's our Director of Special Education Programs. And as Doug alluded to, we're here to request acceptance of a report on the distribution for the ODE's long-term care and treatment program, which is providing for a new minimum staffing standard. This was part of House Bill 5016 in the 2015 session, which is the department's budget bill. And as part of this, we have provided a full written report submitted to you on January 29th. And Mitch is going to talk primarily be the mastermind behind this and has done a just outstanding job in the implementation of this new standard. So I'm going to let him provide an overview of the report. But prior to that, I just want to quickly mention, as Doug alluded to, as part of this process, there is a funding issue that was and will be addressed within Mitch's report. As we went through the implementation of this program, we used 100 classrooms to ultimately define the minimum staffing standard. And with that, we've recognized that there's about a $1.5 million budget shortfall that was put in our legislative request to you. Now, I should just make a quick note that when we originally wrote our letter and submitted for acceptance of this report, we reported out that there was a $4 million shortfall. Since that time, we have discovered there are three programs that have decided to terminate their contract, and there's been some adjustments to the classroom. So when we initially were looking at the budget shortfall, we were at 113 classrooms, and now we're down to 100. So overall, the shortfall that we're looking at for 15-17 is $1.5 million. One other note I would like to make, and again, Mitch, we'll discuss this a little bit, but as part of addressing the 15-17 issue, it will require us to use some program reserves that have been within the program are meant for situations where classroom sizes or the students that we serve that it has increased. It will require us to use or liquidate those reserves. So for 17-19, the actual funding problem will be approximately 3.9. So again, I just wanted to make sure we put that on the record. I know that that isn't the discussion at hand here today, but certainly we can answer any questions that you might have to that. So with that, I'm going to...
Madam Chair.
No, I'm sorry. I was actually reading the report.
Oh.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rick, in these programs, are there any minimum wage folks or lower than $13.50 or $15 an hour folks? And are the projections taking into account what could happen in that arena?
Chair Comp, Chairman Rowe, Representative Huffman, I'm going to let maybe Mitch respond a little more to that, but based on the average salaries that we put together, which was part of this formula, is that we had to establish average salary costs for both teachers as well as aid. My first reaction looking at those numbers is that I think they're above the minimum wage threshold. He's shaking his head yes. But again, I can let him respond to that a little bit more. So I think that on the salary basis right now, Representative Huffman, I would suggest that we're above the minimum wage. We wanted to make sure that these teachers and aides were compensated at an average salary level that the community was seeing for both these positions.
Any other questions for the assistant superintendent?
So with that, I'll turn it over to Mitch, and he will do a summary of the program and as well as the report.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and Representative Huffman, I'll address your answer, your question when we get to the end, and answer the question in a little bit more in detail for you. Chairs Monroe, Comp, members of the committee, Mitch Kreska, Director of Educational Programs with the Oregon Department of Education. excuse me. One of the 12 programs that I oversee is the long-term care and treatment program. And as Rick alluded to with the budget note, there was a request for a report to be submitted to the committee regarding the implementation of the budget note. And so I'm going to go through what is some talking points regarding a summary of the report itself and what is contained in the report. The long-term care and treatment program was created in 1991 for the purpose of providing educational services to students that were placed by state agencies, DHS, OIA, and OHA, in day and residential treatment programs. when it was originally created, it served only those students placed in these programs by those agencies. Educational services paid for through ODE's long-term care and treatment program does not include transportation, care, treatment, or medical expenses. Those services are paid for the student through the agency that places them there. The Department of Education pays strictly for the educational program in the facilities.
Oh, thank you.
At the time the LTCT program was developed, there were 47 agencies or sites statewide that served these students placed by these agencies, and they applied to be part of the LTCT program. These 47 sites became known as, and I'm sure you've heard the term before, the Christie list. These 47 sites, the list of these sites became known as the Christie list because the Christie school was the first name on the list, so we've always referred to it as the Christie list. In 2011, the legislature changed the law and required ODE to provide educational services for all students placed in these facilities. So it went just from serving or paying for the educational services for students placed by state agencies to include students placed privately, placed by parents, or placed by a school district. So we started taking responsibility for the educational services of all the students in the facilities. This increased the number of students served, obviously, by the LTCT program in the 47 sites. It didn't increase the number of sites. It just increased the number of kids that were being served under the program. In addition to the program expansion in 2011, the law also changed the way that ODE was to distribute allocations to the contractors. In the past, ODE provided the services directly. The law changed it to require the school district in which the facility resided was responsible for providing the educational services. ODE was responsible for paying for it. So since then, we've been in contracts. Excuse me. We've done this through contracts with the 26 school districts and ESDs throughout the state where these facilities reside. We, through contractual agreement with them, pay for the educational services. They hire the staff, and actually their staff serve in the facilities. At the time, the distribution of resources to the school districts was based on a per student basis. So the number of students in your facility times net operating expense of the contractor determined the amount of money that went into the contract. In 2014, the legislature created the state school funding task force. That task force had a question for LTCT determining whether or not these programs were currently adequately funded under the LTCT per student model. Based on the research around best practices, ODE came back with an alternative funding model for providing educational services based on a minimum staffing standard so that we could create a baseline whereby we could determine whether or not there was adequate funding. In 2015, the legislature instructed ODE to implement the minimum staffing level recommendation through the budget note. So the budget note directed ODE to implement the minimum staffing standard, minimum staffing level based on the model that ODE had created for our report to the state school funding task force. The budget note called specifically for a minimum standard based on a ratio of staff to students approximately equal to one teacher and two instructional assistants for every 10 students in a classroom, or if the classroom had 15 or more students, one teacher and three instructional assistants. The intention of the budget note was to ensure that students in long-term care and treatment programs received equitable educational services to students in school-based behavioral programs, which is what the standard was based on, best practice in the field. Initially, ODE estimated the budget note would be applied to 92 classrooms across the 47 programs. To provide additional support in implementing the new standard, the 2015 legislature approved an additional $3 million of general fund to increase the 2015-17 LTCT budget to $36.6 million. Implementation of the budget note began immediately. Right after we received the budget note, we began to make changes to the contract in order to implement the budget note request of the minimum staffing standard for the 15-16 school year. In July of 2015, through the contracts, we successfully implemented the standard across all 47 programs. So we were able to make that shift rather quickly. The total classrooms, however, supported, we originally estimated 92. The actual number when we began to communicate with and work with our contractors was actually 113 classrooms. Since the implementation in July, three programs, as Rick alluded to, three programs have closed. Okay, then that's related to the facilities themselves and the students that are placed there by the agencies and the funding they received. Those, because of that, those programs had to close, which decreased the number of classrooms to 100 classrooms, which is where we currently are. The department estimates that these 100 classrooms will provide educational services to over 950 students on an annual basis. Using the application of the new minimum staffing standard, the total estimated LTCT program cost for 2015-17 is $41.9 million, which includes a $1.6 million set-aside required by law for emergency funding. We're required to set aside up to 5% for emergency funding in case something comes up that one of the programs was unable to budget for. We have an emergency fund for them. Based on the $36.6 million biennial budget, the funding gap for 15-17 is approximately $5.3 million. However, the program has $3.8 million in reserve funding that was applied, which reduces the overall need for 15-17 to $1.5 million. Anticipating the liquidation of the funding reserves and emergency funds, ODE estimates the funding need in 2017-19, the next biennium, to be approximately $3.9 million. The budget note also requested a comment from the department on measuring the effectiveness of the implementation of the program. And asked us to provide a proposal for measuring that effectiveness. Through the new minimum staffing standard, ODE has the ability to require, through the contract, one teacher and a minimum one aide for every classroom. That in and of itself is an improvement, because now we can be assured that every classroom has a certified teacher teaching these students. At the same time, we are increasing educational support. The presence of the adequate staff and in the classrooms also increases safety and security for both the staff and the students, given the nature of the students that we serve in the LTCT program. However, due to the uniqueness of the program structure and the uniqueness of the students that are served in these programs, it really makes it difficult to provide one specific measure of program effectiveness, because there are so many things that are involved with these students, the mental health needs, the care needs, the treatment needs, that there really isn't one measure that you can look at to measure effectiveness. So in the report, as an alternative, ODE will be looking, as we have in the past, at multiple sources of data to demonstrate or to evaluate whether or not the program is effectively serving the education of these students. In summary, the new minimum staffing standard has been fully implemented at 100% in all classrooms in the current facilities. While the overall cost to deliver this model is 10.8% higher than what was originally estimated, ODE believes the benefits of both increased student outcomes and reduced safety and security risks are a good return on the investment that the legislature has made. And with that, I will take any questions.
Representative Huffman and Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if OYA puts out an RFP for school districts to put in a proposal for a contract at NorCor, for example, in the Dalles, that RFP would spell out that it, and I want to make sure I'm hearing right, because it sounds like maybe their contract is going to have to include more than just education. It'll include more of a package, including mental health and other things? Or would District 21 provide, for example, the educational classroom stuff, the teacher and whatnot, and then other people like Nextdoor or somebody, another contractor, would put in a proposal for the mental health type stuff?
Right.
How many different components are we actually dealing with?
Chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Huffman, that's the complication of understanding long-term care and treatment. There really are two sides to the long-term care and treatment coin. There is the facility side. The facilities are private facilities that serve students with mental health and behavioral issues. Those programs are paid for, and their funding comes from the agency that places students in those programs. So OHA with Nextdoor would pay for a certain number of beds in their facility that facility then would hold for them when they had students that they needed to place into that facility. Under the law, the Oregon Department of Education and through the local school district is responsible for providing the educational services to the students that are placed in the facility. So let's say through OHA and OIA, there are 10 students placed in facility X. Those 10 students need an education program. If that program is one of the long-term care and treatment Christie List school programs, then ODE provides the adequate staffing through the contract with the school district to provide a teacher and an assistant to educate those students. The education can occur in the facility if they have the room, if they have a room space available, or the education can occur in the school district. That occurs in some of the programs where the students are bused to the school and they actually receive the services in a classroom at the school. The two never cross the line. The ODE and the school district provide the educational staff and the educational program. The facility pays for, through their contract with the agency that's placing the child there, for all of the other needs. Mental health, if it's a residential program, care and treatment, food, all of those things are paid for. The two really never cross over. They're totally separate. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and a follow-up. So our programs throughout the state, because you've been working on this, you know, because we've, over the couple of biennia period, passed some laws to try to get the funding where it needs to be and channeled more appropriately, in our opinion. But so are all of the programs up to that one teacher and two aides per 10 students now, and this is just an ask to continue what we've already set in place?
Yes. Chairs, Representative Husband, yes. Again, the prior to the budget note, the staffing or the funding for these programs was based on a per student. So if you had 10 students in your program, we determined based on the amount of revenue that was available to the program, what per student allocation you would receive for your program. When we shifted to what the budget note calls a minimum staffing standard, we now provide adequate funding to your program to pay for a teacher and two aides in every classroom. So if you have one classroom in your program because of the number of students, you may have one teacher and two aides. If you have 20 kids, you probably have two teachers and four aides, and so on and so on. Some of our programs have as many as 7 to 10 classrooms, so you can imagine that it goes from there. So yes, there is now, in my opinion as the director of the program, adequate educational services being provided to each one of the classrooms, which in the past we could not necessarily have said that with the certainty that we can now.
Great, thanks.
Okay.
Just a moment. Good morning, Senator Thompson.
Good morning.
You're late.
I had some important state business to
take
care of.
Okay, good. Okay. Representative Springer and then Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair. As I look at your budget note document, on the bottom of page 4 and the top of page 5, you're talking about funding and the funding for the distribution formula, and that unlike most of the formula, state law is not what is dictating this allocation. It was written by rule through ODE. Good or bad, it's just a different process. So as I look at that, and you're talking about it, you are mentioning here, the document mentions that the slots are at the weight of either 1.75 or 2.0 to calculate the funding that would be provided on a yearly basis. And then under the 2.0, there's a footnote that it talks about, as you know, the calculation was first done in 2009, which I've never been able to find out in my research how that decision came about.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed rather random, quite frankly. So talk to me a little bit about that and where we're at in that process.
Chairs, Representative Springer, that is no longer relevant because with the introduction of the minimum staffing standard, the calculation that we did and used in the past, the NOE times the weight that you're referring to, it essentially became obsolete. And so we went in and we have a temporary rule in the OAR replacing that rule with the minimum staffing standard called out for in the budget note. So that no longer exists in rule.
Glad to hear that.
Okay.
Representative Taylor and then Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Chair Kump. I just had a quick question about the when you started. I'm just looking for it here and I'm not finding it. It's $49 million without the reserves. It's $49 million every year on the biennium.
No, Chairs, Representative Taylor, it's $49 million for the biennium.
It is biennium.
Yeah,
okay.
It is $49 for the biennium.
Okay,
yes.
Great. Thank you so much.
I don't think it's 49.
Yeah, it's
roughly $42 million, I believe.
Yeah.
I'm not. Yeah, was it 42? Again, a lot of numbers floating. I believe it is 42. Yeah, 41 and some change, $42 million. Yes, I think that is correct.
Okay. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you give us the scope of these programs? Because this does not, I don't believe, include the hospital health for kids that are in long-term, or does it include some of those people that have long-term cancer needs, they're going to be in hospital for a year or so? What's the scope? What kinds of kids are included in all of this program? Because I get confused every once in a while. I understand parts of them because they're pretty simple, but just for me, I'd like to have an idea of who all is included.
Co-Chair, Senator Roblin, it's great question. This program is separate from the hospital's program. We have a separate program that I also am the director of that provides services, educational services to several different hospital programs, including Randall's, Dornbecker's, and of course I can't remember the others off the top of my head. This program specifically serves day and residential treatment programs that address specifically students who have mental health and behavioral needs that require them to receive special treatment beyond what can be provided in a regular educational setting with behavioral supports. It's the students who are severe enough or have severe enough behaviors that they need a step up in care. And so these are the students that are placed in day and residential treatment programs, and those are the educational services. We're providing educational services to those students. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, partially. To include those that are adjudicated. Is that right?
That are, excuse me?
Adjudicated youth, so in some of our other institutions?
Some of these, I believe there's a couple of the residential programs that have adjudicated youth in them. Yes, that is correct. And those are the students that are placed by OYA.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But, Madam Chair, there is a third program for those that are either in OYA facilities or in county juvenile programs. There's a separate funding stream for them.
Yes, that is the Youth Corrections Education Program and the Juvenile Detention Education Program is specifically the educational program that I also oversee that provides educational services specifically in the juvenile detention facilities or the youth corrections facilities, McLaren, Hillcrest, Oak Creek. So they're three separate, entirely different programs with three separate, entirely separate funding streams that serve all of those kids.
Well, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for the information. It was really well laid out. I think it's I like the idea of going from a per student to a minimum staffing. I hope that I'm eager to see how ODE decides to measure that, and I think there's a lot of good options in here. I did just want to kind of check on, I'm assuming that you will now know definitively how many classrooms there are from here going forward because you're using that number. And I just wondered if you could talk about why there was the misunderstanding or not knowing, like going, you thought it was 92, but it was actually 113. And then I understand why it dropped back down. But where did that come from?
Co-chairs, Representative Smith Warner. Because in all the time that ODE has worked with the contractors, it really the funding that was provided to the contractors was very similar to the way that the funding is provided to a school district. We give them their lump sum of money, and then we monitor them to make sure that they're providing the educational services that are required under Division 22 standards and also by the contract. So we never really had a reason to reach out and find out exactly how many classrooms each facility had. We knew exactly how many students were being served because we do a monthly count at several different levels, but we never really had taken the time or really felt the need to look at the number of classrooms. Obviously, this budget note shifted that significantly, and so then we had to reach out and find out for the purposes of funding allocation exactly how many classrooms were being served in each facility.
Okay. And can I briefly follow up? So my assumption would then be that from here on out, you'll know both of those. Those will be, you'll know both of those pieces.
Yeah, Representative, we will know exactly how many, because right now we're in the process of preparing contracts for next year. And so right now we're in the process of finding out how many classrooms do you have? Are there any requests for expansion? Because we constantly have programs that are requesting the opportunity to add a high school classroom, or OIA, OHA, or DHS reaches out to them and says, look, in our area in Burns, we have a need to serve some middle school students that we don't serve now, so do we have the opportunity to expand? So yes, because the contracts themselves are built on the actual number of classrooms, so we know exactly how many classrooms there are.
And Chair Comp, Chairman Rowe, Representative Smith Warner, to your question specifically, yes, absolutely. As we go forward, I think there will be a lot more preciseness in the numbers because, like Mitch said, this is based on classrooms. We are now looking at 100. I think the one other element, though, and I don't know that Mitch completely touched on this, but I think it's an important point in his report, is that the nature of the mental health services in the state is beginning to shift more to in-home care services, and that is, I think, one of the primary results of the three programs that are now dropped off. The question will be, are we going to see more of that? And we talked about the Christie list and the 47, and at this point, this program is just focused on those 47. I would imagine as time goes along, and if that shift were to continue, we may see more of the programs drop off and the cost decrease. I think the question then at hand is that, do you evaluate potentially other providers that are out there that are providing the same types of services but aren't on the Christie list?
And that's in the report about the transition.
Yeah. It is. That leads me to a question that I have. Representative Springer and I were recently out at McLaren and spoke with their students. And one student, and I don't know that he fits into this category, but as the discussion evolved, and he was getting services through one type of funding, but he wasn't getting any services through the Oregon Health Association. So he was getting services through OYA, but not through the
OHA.
Whew, thank you. And so I'm wondering about the safety net under the students. We're talking about classrooms, we're talking about the teacher ratio and all those things, but how are you, particularly, and this even becomes more critical as we move to in-home care, how are you guys going to keep all that straight?
Co-chairs, Chair Comp, we don't. Luckily, it's not an issue for us. because the Department of Education doesn't have to address the issues with paying for care treatment, similar to what this young man was referring to. The care and treatment is, it does, it's not the responsibility of the Department of Education to oversee that. It's OHA, OIA, or whoever else is paying for the services. Luckily for me, as the director, I focus on the educational services and providing the educational services.
Okay.
Yeah, you got it. Amen. Yeah.
He just calls DHS if he thinks they're not getting what they need.
Exactly. Thank you. That's what I would do. I would pass it on to one of my colleagues in the other agencies that actually are responsible for answering
questions. Yeah. And it was interesting because a staff person was sitting next to this young man, and she nudged him and said, talk to me after we get finished. And so I knew what was going to happen. But again, it was an example. Here was a student that was advocating for himself because he was very cognizant of his rights and that sort of thing. But how does a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old know those things? But I don't. Yeah, it's just, and having been a school administrator and sat through, I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of IEP meetings, but I know students are very intellectually aware of what they can and what they should, services they do need. So
I agree.
Yeah. Senator Roblin?
Yeah. That brings up the other question. As we do start seeing more kids move to home health care with regard to these issues, are we following up to make sure that they're getting educational support when they leave the program? Is someone following find out if the child is getting the education support they need? Because these kids get lost from a school district to another place, and all of a sudden they don't report back to the school district, so they just go home. And that makes me very nervous.
Mm-hmm. Co-chairs, Senator Roblin, I couldn't agree with you more. As a special ed administrator for many years, the emphasis that we've placed in the contracts with these folks on transition and doing appropriate transition is key to the work that they do. So the educational program, when they know they're working closely in the facility, because it's required under the law and under contract, that the educational and the mental health, the treatment service folks are working closely together, so that as a student gets ready to transition back, oftentimes with these students, having been a special ed director and dealt with these students, you will see a step-up plan where the student will begin to work with the educational service, the neighborhood school where they're going back to, and they may start with maybe visiting 1 hour a day, a couple of days a week, and then they may go to a half a day, then eventually step up. So the transition for these students is probably one of the most crucial parts to the treatment program as it comes to an end, and is absolutely as the director, an absolute requirement of these programs that they are doing adequate transition. And it is one of the areas that we monitor very closely with each facility.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
So do we do a follow-up check-in a year later or so to see if that stuff was followed through with?
To be honest with you, Senator Roblin, we don't do to that degree. No, we do not.
That just makes me nervous sometimes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. It would make me nervous too. Yeah. Especially they have to take that test sometime.
Or repeatedly.
Or repeatedly, yes. Co-Chair Monroe.
Yeah, as Senator Roblin, I'm concerned about the transition. The staffing level in your program are pretty high, really. Much higher than they're going to get in a public school, where they may just have a teacher and maybe not, you know, a teacher and two aides for 10 kids. I mean, that's pretty good staffing. And then when they transition from that program back to the public school, how does that work out? I mean, strikes me that that's quite a difficult transition. And how are you involved in working with the local school officials to make sure that that transition is relatively seamless and continues to meet their educational needs?
Mm-hmm. Co-chair, Senator Monroe, many of these kids, if not most of them, are students who have special education services and are on an individual education plan. So oftentimes the transition back to the school district will be to a specific classroom behavioral program at the school district. They don't necessarily transition from a treatment program to a regular fifth grade classroom. There's usually an interim step where they'll go to maybe the district may have a behavioral classroom within the school or a behavioral classroom somewhere within the district. They'll transition to that program. And in most behavior classrooms, again, having been a special ed director, set up and run these classrooms, the staffing level in a behavior classroom is generally one teacher and two assistants. And the reason being is if I've got 10 kids in my classroom and little Johnny blows out and it requires two people to escort that young man from the classroom, I can't leave the other nine students unaccounted or alone. So having a third body in the classroom in order to continue the educational program and keep things moving is crucial in a behavior classroom. So to answer your question, most of these students don't transition back to a regular classroom. If they do, they have special education services, in which case there's often a special educational assistant that is in the classroom providing support for this student. So it really isn't just transitioning the student from one of these high levels of treatment and services just back to, if you will, throwing them into a regular classroom. The transition is far more elaborate and far more thought out than that as they transition back.
Continuing.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
When they're in your program, they're getting not only their slice of the school fund, mm-hmm. a weighted slice, I'm assuming, two weights, 2.5.
Actually, it's their single weight for the state school fund drawdown is just a single weight. The weights that Representative Springer referred to really weren't equivalent to an ADM weight. It was a weight that was attributed within the formula that we used to calculate how to allocate the funding. Luckily, it's gone away, so I'm not going to try and explain it. But no, these students for the state school fund, they're a straight single weight because of the general fund allocation on top of it. So they don't take an additional weight from the state school fund.
So that general fund, which and the federal funds pay for about half your program.
That is correct,
48%. Program.
Yes.
So when that student then transitions back to the public school,
mm-hmm.
Wouldn't they then get a weighted?
Yes, they would. That okay. is correct. So when they transition back to the public school and this public school begins to count them for the ADMW collection, if they were special ed, they would get the double weight
yeah.
and any other additional items that they may any other additional weights that may come with that. Yes.
Okay.
That is correct.
Yeah, thank you. That helps.
Senator Roland, thank you, Senator
thank
Monroe.
You. So we have a longitudinal database which we funded and hopefully it's going to happen. Have we done any research over the long term on these kids with regard to how long they stay in these places, what success was involved in their ability to move forward? Because I'm concerned many of these, this is the most stable educational program they've had in their lives because the parents are not necessarily in stable settings and they move, so they go to one district after another and they go through long waits to get their new IEP set up and so on. Once they're in this program, they pretty much stay there. Even if the parent moves around, they get to stay at that place. I would love to see over time if there's any indication that these programs are more than back to the home school program. I worry as we make these transitions, which sound good, are they really being helpful for kids? And I'm hopeful that the legislative database will start giving us some answers to questions that have festered with many of us for a long time. So,
co-chairs, Senator Roblin, unfortunately, I don't know if that would be possible because the changes that occur, these decisions that are made on how long a student is in one of these programs are made on an individual basis. And then, again, as Rick alluded to in his opening statement, these programs for years, as I was a special ed director, were basically the triage placements where when they had a student with gotcha. Major mental health or behavioral issues, they went to these programs. Under the new CCO model, that model is changing okay. to where now they're providing the mental health services in the home setting. And again, I as a psychologist by training, I understand that you want the family involved. But what that's done is it's now required the school district to deal with what was being dealt with before in these programs in their school setting. So that when those programs fail, these students are then placed in these programs for triage. And what used to be a 6-month paid for placement is now 30 to 90 day placement. Okay. And so it's really difficult to say in that short period of time how successful these kids are or aren't. And again, I want to make it clear, that's not anything, education has no control over how long these students are placed for. That is all determined by the funding from the agency that's placing them there. Once they're there, we educate them, but we have no control over who places them there, how long they're there, or what the treatment program is.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
That's perfect.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. And you've done a great job in sharing lots of information with us. As we all know, this we're highly sensitive to taking care of our children, and so I appreciate it.
Amen.
Does DAS have a recommendation for us about the report? Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we agree to acknowledge receipt of the report. We're suggesting that they provide an update to through their budget presentation in the next session, 2017 session, and update on the program, what's happening, if any, you know, more folks or programs have closed, funding problems or funding solutions, and then also a little more discussion on how to measure success. The report here doesn't suggest anything other than saying you need to look at a wide set of data. It seems to me that it still is important to track in some way how successful these programs. So an update on that during the budget presentation also.
Very easily done, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, move that we acknowledge receipt of the report with Doug's notation included in the motion.
Okay, Senator Monroe moves that we accept receipt of the report and additional LFO recommendations for the 2017 session. Any discussion? Any objections? So moved.
Thank you.
Thank you. I do have a question.
You have a question now?
Well, a statement.
Oh, a statement.
May
go
I?
For
may
it.
I?
Yes, and then you might get to carry this to the full.
That would be fine. Rick, I don't know.
We don't do that, do we?
We do on this one.
I don't know if you heard the Ways and Means hearing a few weeks ago after the maintenance report given on the School for the Deaf, but I had mentioned in there that you gladly said you would be coming back with a report on the maintenance efforts and addressing Rep. Springer's question. So while I had you here, I thought I would mention that I had said that on the record.
Oh, so are you requesting a report about?
Not today. He did it already.
Well, yeah, not today. Putting him on the spot.
So no comment needed. I just wanted to tell you what I had said that you said you were going to do, and
you could have shared that with Mr. Wilson.
Well, I just did.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, Representative Huffman, I appreciate you reminding me that I was aware that I am to follow back with you and provide additional information as that comes.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Wow, awkward moment.
Okay. Carrier, Representative Huffman, and I think that's all we need.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't need to go to the Senate.
Going to close the informational hearing on long-term care and treatment program and open the informational hearing on online charter school programs. Cindy Hunt and Kate Pattison. And if you want to be briefer than the first report, that's fine with us, but we'd like to make sure you have full, yeah, you've got plenty of time.
Fabulous.
I know, Cindy, you can talk quickly. Yes, Senator Roebling.
Usually they do it on a per pupil basis, and they had 900 in the last one. They have more.
Oh, okay. Got it.
My name is Cindy Hunt. I'm the Government Legal Affairs Manager for the Oregon Department of Education. And today I've brought with me Kate Pattison, who is our Director for Public Charter Schools in Oregon. As Doug Wilson mentioned earlier, this is in response to a request from Senator Monroe, I believe it was last fall when we were last before you on charter schools, to come back to you with information about achievement and financing for virtual education in Oregon. So today, what you're going to see us focused on is the virtual charter school specifically, because frankly, that's what a lot of the focus is around virtual ed. And it's also because these schools are tracked individually, we have better information on achievement and financing and so forth. But I did want to mention that virtual education is not just the purview of the charter schools in Oregon. We do have school districts who have virtual programs. There is a wide variety of virtual programs across Oregon. Some districts, you know, have what we would call a blended model, where a student might attend one, two, you know, three classes virtually and then go to just a regular classroom, for example. So in that kind of a model, it's difficult to ascribe the student's achievement to virtual education versus the regular classroom. That's what I mean. It's kind of hard, right? We also have the Oregon Virtual School District, which is not a school district, it's a program, and it supplies educational services to school districts across Oregon who are virtual. We have contracts with virtual providers and those kinds of things. So there's a wide variety out there, but today you'll see us focusing on our virtual charter schools, which are the ones who are, you know, as far as virtual programs, talked about the most in the building. With that, Kate.
All right, good morning. My name's Kate Pattison, Charter School Specialist at the Department of Education, and I'm going to talk a little bit about virtual public charter schools this morning. So first, a little background just to make sure we're all on the same page. Public charter schools are public schools that are comprehensive elementary or secondary schools within the system. They are public schools of choice where students can choose to attend or choose to leave. They are considered a component school in the district. They're authorized and accountable to a sponsor. And so typically that's a school district, but it could also be the State Board of Education or potentially an institution of higher education, although we don't have any of those at this time.
Yeah.
They must comply with federal law, and they must comply with most of the education laws for schools, but not all of them. They have some autonomy and flexibility. So this map shows you all 126 public charter schools in the state, where they are located, and you can see that there is definitely a concentration, but they are across the state in all regions. We do have 126 public charter schools in Oregon. There are 77 district sponsors, so they are the largest number. Most charter schools are sponsored by districts. There are 18 single school district charter schools. So that's where a district only has one school and that one school is a charter school. There are 13 virtual public charter schools in the state and 4 public charter schools that are sponsored by the State Board of Education. In 2014-15, there were almost 30,000 students enrolled in public charter schools, and that equates to about 5.5% of public students in the state. So virtual public charter schools. A virtual public charter school is a school that's, again, established through a performance contract with a sponsor, and they serve students primarily not in a physical location. And so the bullet points below here go into a little bit more detail about what that looks like. Instruction and content are delivered primarily through electronic means. Student and teachers are in different physical locations. Online and instructional activities are integral to the academic program. Students are not required to be located in the physical location of the school to participate. More than 50% of the core courses are offered online, so that would be your core academic courses, English, math, science, etc. More than 50% of students attending receive instructional services online, and more than 50% of the required instructional time is provided online. And so we do have some virtual public charter schools that do have more of a blended model where students do come in on site. Some are even focused a little bit more regionally and require a certain amount of on-site attendance. However, in order to be categorized as a virtual public charter school, if they meet these requirements, then they would be bound to those laws specifically for virtual public charter schools. So in the state here, you can see the 13 virtual public charter schools and where they're located. And again, we see that same kind of concentration, but again, that representation around the state in the different regions where these schools are located. Last year, the 13 virtual public charter schools were as listed here, and you can see in this the date they opened, and we have a wide range. Some of these schools opened as early as 2005, 2003, and some as recent as 2014. And then the different sponsors, you can see the grade span here. Most are serving students K-12. There are three charter schools that are serving students mostly in the secondary grades. You can see the overall enrollment. There's close to 9,000 students in virtual public schools last year, and the different district sponsors there. These two charter schools you may have heard about last year changed sponsorship. Technically, what happened was the schools closed and then were sponsored by another school district. And so we have the Insight School of Oregon. They were non-renewed by Crook County and were then sponsored by another school district. And the Oregon Connections Academy terminated their charter contract with SIO and then were sponsored by the Santiam Canyon School District. So here are those two details for your record. So to get into a little bit of the academic performance of these schools, I don't have it specific to which school. We can definitely provide that information in a more detailed chart. But for the visual here, you can see the line represents the Oregon state average. And this is academic performance on Smarter Balance for English Language Arts. And you can see the distribution of performance for the virtual public charter schools. Here is for math, where we see much lower distribution across the board.
That hurts.
And I would just like to point out in both of these, well, at least in this one here, the one that is above, that is the Paisley School District. Paisley School District is one of those single school charter schools. It's a single school district, and their one school also has a virtual component, and it's enough of a virtual component that it qualifies as a virtual public charter school, but they also have a boarding school component to their school. Sure. And so it's a little bit of anomaly. It's hard to compare all these schools to each other because even within virtual public charter schools, you have all different kinds of programs and a variety there. So it's a little hard to even do this and put them all on the same page together, but for the sake of the generic definition, this is where we are.
We have a question. Representative Springer.
Actually, it's not a question, it's a comment. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As we look at these, and I'm one who has consistently said in this building, before I came into this building, if our graduation rate's not 100%, then we're not doing good enough. And if our attendance isn't 100%, then we may not be doing good enough. And that said, I look at those numbers, and some of those are really quite disturbing. And because I've done a lot of work on charter schools and looking at what they're doing and how they're performing and how they compare, because those numbers, when I saw numbers like similar to that the first time, I went, geez, this is a process that's not working. You know, what is wrong here? And then I dove down a little bit and looked at it, and these are students that are struggling, not all of them, but the vast majority of them are struggling in traditional brick and mortar or a different setting, whatever that setting would be. And so they're coming here, and when I look at graduation rates of charter schools, which are lower than a lot of our brick and mortars, virtuals, lower than our brick and mortars, I become very concerned with that also. And then when I dive down, these were kids that were not on track at all to graduate in brick and mortar. So are the numbers okay? No. But I think it's very important for us to look at the context in which those numbers show up.
Definitely. Co-chairs and Representative Springer, most of the time when I'm talking with the virtual charter school providers, there is the conversation about the students, who they're serving, and the breakdown of the data, which goes into a lot of students are entering, you know, credit deficient, yeah, way off track
vast
for graduation.
Majority of them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative.
So here again, you can see the Oaks Science for last year, and that 82 again is Paisley, and graduation rates across the board here reflects what we were just talking about. So funding for virtual public charter schools. All charter schools are funded as per required in the charter school statute, and they must establish a contract negotiated amount, and that negotiated amount is of the charter rate, which is the district's general purpose grant divided by the district's current year ADMW. And what I would say to that is, if we wanted to go into a whole presentation on that, we would invite Michael Elliott to break that all down. But if you take that, and then it's based on per pupil, there are the weights associated. For district-sponsored charter schools, for K-8 students, it's a minimum of 80%. And for 9-12 students, it's a minimum of 95%. And you can see then for state-sponsored charter schools and institutions of higher education sponsored charter schools is a different percentage rate, but all of the virtual public charter schools that we're talking about are district authorized schools, and so we're talking about the 80% and 95%.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kump. Can you go back to the previous slide, please, about the graduation rates? Is that say, is there a school where it was zero, or not a single?
Yes, and again, when you look at all the different types of data and types of schools, yes. There are a couple of these virtual charter schools where they're serving very few students in cooperative agreements, which is a whole different part of the charter school law. And so I believe it could be related to those schools where they're not going to have very much data in the first place. So we're talking about a very small number of students. We're also talking about these virtual public charter schools that are working in partnership with districts to serve students who might not be succeeding, taking a few courses. And so I can't get into the very specifics of that, but it did report as zero.
Representative Huffman and then Representative Smith-Warner, and I know you have to leave.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that, when we had the online learning task force back in 08 or 09 or whenever, I fought long and hard to make sure that online learning was available, because oftentimes in rural Oregon, we don't have the budgets or the teachers certified to meet certain subjects. And so I had made sure that the online providers were allowed to contract in a cafeteria basis with certain school districts, and that's part of what's being addressed. Now, I don't know what those numbers are, but it's an effort to try to be able to provide fifth grade science to Condon, you know, and stuff like that, or advanced placement courses to high school students in Fossil or whatever.
Follow-up, because I want to get to Representative Smith-Warner. Okay. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to, no, I appreciate the desire to provide classes online. I just was concerned about a school with a really low graduation rate, and I appreciate that there are individuals who are struggling, and it probably could very well be better than where they would be otherwise. This is just a really tough, sounds like a pretty tough situation. Yeah, so I just didn't want to confuse those two subjects.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize because I have another place that I have to be, but I do not, my primary concern is the difference between the reimbursement rate for an online charter school versus a brick-and-mortar charter school. And do those contracts that they enter into with the school districts, are you reimbursed at the same rate whether you are a brick-and-mortar charter school or an online charter school?
Co-chairs and Representative Smith-Warner, yes. It is based on the type of student that you have and the type of sponsor that you have, so the grade span of the students.
Okay.
So K-8 students are at least 80%, and then 9-12 students are at least 95%.
But the online versus brick-and-mortar is the same.
Right. There's no differentiation.
That is just my significant concern. I think you can make a pretty decent argument for a public charter that has the same expenses as a brick-and-mortar, period. But the online, I don't think you can make that same argument as far as the teacher-to-student ratio, all sorts of other elements that just aren't there. And I'm concerned about the use of our, you know, the allocation, the fair allocation of our scarce public dollar for education resources in that way. I'm just making an announcement rather than criticizing you about it. So
Okay.
But I'm sure I would like to hear what Senator Roblin has to say about that.
Yes, Senator Roblin.
Before I go.
Just a statement that if you read it, it says at least. Mm-hmm. It is a negotiated agreement between the school board and the charter school. The online charter schools have done a better job of negotiating.
And I would argue with even less need.
I'm just saying they have done a better. Almost all of the K-8 and others are at those levels. There's a few that have a little bit more, but most of them pretty much. The ones that are different from that are the total school district ones. They get 100% because they are the school district and they are the charter school. So that's a different relationship. In my watching that, they've done a little bit better in negotiating with the school districts.
And I might argue that I might argue for that there is a decent argument to be made that we should have different maximums for them versus a physical brick and mortar charter.
There are no maximums.
Right.
In the current law, so it's
minimums then.
I don't know that minimums would change it. I'm just saying that's if you go and ask what their contracts are, it's going to be there will be a little bit of a disparity.
Right. So maybe we could. Co-chairs, maybe we could change it from minimums to maximums.
Co-chair Monroe.
Yeah, I think it's becoming abundantly clear why I ask for this report.
And Kate, I would advise you just to continue with your report. Okay.
So this slide that I've put up this morning includes, based on what we have on file right now and to the best of our ability in reading through their charter contracts, an estimate of where they are, the virtual public charter schools, in negotiating the percent of funds allocated to them. And so you can see there the percent negotiated down the middle. A lot of them are at the minimum, the 80 and 95, and some have negotiated higher rates. What's in parentheses there is what I've extrapolated either from the contract or through conversations about individual service agreements that the charter schools have with the districts for different percents paid back to the district for services or so on and so forth. So like for Baker Web Academy, the first one there, their minimum that they're going to receive is 80%, but then they also, the district is covering at least up to 15% of additional services for the charter school. So in that case, Baker School District is providing facilities, staffing, a lot of other resources, and has really integrated the virtual charter school into a lot of the district offerings for students there. And you can see the differentiation there. And then the Oregon Virtual Education schools, those are operated by cooperative agreements. So there's, again, individual funding contracts with each individual district that they're working with. So it is complicated. I don't necessarily even have all of the information for this. So if you have questions, I would definitely refer you to talk individually with every district sponsor and the charter school to make sure you have all of the contracts in front of you before this is taken as the final answer on that.
Thank you.
And then in 2015, Credo published a pretty extensive and study on virtual charter schools across the nation. And this was really to look at the impact on student academic progress in virtual charter schools. It's a very critical look at how students are performing in virtual charter schools. Oregon is included in this, and so I'd encourage you to all to take a look at it if you're specifically looking at academic performance. It does have a more narrow view and definition of what a virtual charter school is. So I don't know specifically which of our 13 virtual charter schools were looked at, but it wasn't all of them.
Thank you.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure, absolutely, Representative Springer.
You just said you're not sure which ones are included or something like that. I haven't looked at that document yet, and I'm going there now. Will it at least give us, I know you don't know, and that's okay, will it tell us what school they're talking about?
Yes, co-chairs, and it's all in there.
Okay. And when I just clicked on it, it says not found.
Oh,
so
we can make sure that you have a copy of that.
Madam Chair, just as logistics, these are PDF files that you see here.
Okay.
And so you got to type in.
Oh.
That's a limitation of OLIS.
Actually, I think you can copy the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But pressing won't work.
That's true.
Or clicking.
Got it. Thank you. That's very helpful. Any last comments for this presentation? Great. Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe, did you have any comments at this time about this?
Well, like I said, this is a very important presentation to give us a little more information. I'd like to know more about which students get involved in, you know, a virtual program, a virtual charter program, and why. Is it because they failed in a brick and mortar school? Sounds to me like maybe in many cases that may be the actual reason. And if they failed in a brick and mortar school and they're not doing very well in a virtual charter school, maybe there's other reasons for that other than the just comparing the two programs. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, like Kate alluded to, we don't have specific data on, you know, specifically like what are the reasons for a student choosing this as an option. However, when we receive phone calls and inquiries from parents, you see a wide range of reasons being given. Everything from I'm not happy with my local school district. I feel like my child needs a break from the local school district. We have parents that have shared that they've taken their student and put them into a virtual setting for like a year to give them that break, and then they come back to the regular school kind of setting. We have individuals who have expressed it was around flexibility. For example, we have an OD employee whose child was a ski racer and needed flexibility to get her education while she pursued ski racing. And then you also have the students who are credit deficient, and they also need the flexibility to attain those credits, you know, to achieve their education. But then when you look at the different virtual schools, I think they're attracting different groups of students too, you know, so that kind of is dependent on, you know, these individual schools as well. So I think you get a wide range of answers to that question.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, yes. You know, having been a public school teacher, I believe that we give students more than just academics, that socialization, the ability to interact with other students and with a live teacher, those are certainly advantages that you don't get in a virtual program. So I would hope that when it's possible, we provide students with the full gamut of opportunities for developing into successful human beings, and that's not just academics.
Mm-hmm. Co-chair Roblin, I was going to give you a bump up, and then Representative Springer.
So just a couple things. One, I would love to know the percentage of kids that are homeschooled, if we have that information. Because it's interesting, this is about 5%, a little over 5% in this group. And if you take the onlines, they're about 1.5% or so. You've got the two large charter schools. They represent around 1%, a little less. So percentage-wise, these are not large percentages of our total population of kids. And it would also be good at some point, I think, and I know some of the charter schools do this, some don't, to get a parent satisfaction criteria from them about where they're at in their regular public school, because we did that a lot in our schools, try to figure out where the kinds of things are. And the one that you didn't mention that I would mention that came up in a number of parents was safety. We have very fearful parents who do not want sending their kids to any public buildings, and they have chosen this because it makes them feel better, and I will bet that from a mental health perspective makes it better for their kids, because you don't need panicky people worrying about their kids all the time. It can create some other kinds of problems. So there, but I agree with you. I think there, for just about each kid, there's another reason. So they'll clump from time to time, but in groups, but I think it's a really difficult decision. I'm kind of surprised when you think of 126 school district charter schools that the percentage is still as low as it is. It's never really gotten, it started out, and it's pretty much held that position after a few years, percentage-wise, as I've seen it. So, I find that interesting, too.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And actually, I would have a request, and I think that this conversation has been really good to set the stage and prompt us to think about some things, and it gave us questions. And I think that we would be incomplete in this process if we didn't have a charter school come in and talk to us about who their kids are and what they do and address issues like socialization. In fact, I'd look at socialization and I'd say that's one of the reasons we have kids in charter schools is because, good or bad, virtuals, good or bad, substantiated or not, we have parents feeling like the bullying wasn't addressed. Mm-hmm. And so we need to look at that. And I know that the teacher content is, in fact, I spoke with a lady at the COSA conference last weekend when I spoke there, and her job was, frankly, to just dog parents and students to be there all the time, which I think is great. That is great. So I think it's really important for us, and obviously, it's no secret, I'm in a unique position with virtuals in this state, and sometimes an interesting position. And so I've had a lot of contact with charters, and I've had these very same questions because I think they're very legitimate questions, and I'd like to see a robust and a full conversation in this contest around those questions.
Thank you. Representative Huffman, and then we're going to adjourn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, if online work group does move forward, like there's a proposal out there, I would certainly like for them to I would hope they would be looking at more than just funding, and they would try to get to the bottom of that zero number out there, and is that zero the reason, because there are a lot of students within districts taking one class or something like that, and it's not tied, well, overall it would be tied to graduation, but not to the numbers of the online school. Mm-hmm. And make sure that online is represented in the work group. Senator Roblin and I had a meeting yesterday on charter schools, and had in an interim work group that will move forward. We had, and I had to leave a little early, but I think we left it where there would be equal representation on the work group of charter school administrators, teacher, etc., so that we could get good answers, qualitative stuff to make decisions.
Good. Senator Roblin?
Yeah, just one last question, and it goes to Charles in general. As you've noted, there are a group of charter schools, and it's probably been growing as fast as any of them, and that's this total district charter school. And it is in response to the fact that they can't afford to run their school based on the school fund, and this gives them some options to do some different things. I'm interested to see that a couple of them met the requirement as being online, because that was probably not their original intent. It was mostly to keep their school district going and their schools. And we've got to come have a conversation at some point about, we give money, extra money to small schools. We've done a lot of different kinds of things to keep small schools. At what point, you know, does the state keep doing that or helping and making them choose other choices? I mean, we've made it a little easier. They don't have to have two school boards to manage the same exact organization any longer, which we used to have to do. They had to have a charter school board, and then they have an elected board. A lot of that stuff is in response to the fact we have very small school districts, very expensive spaces, so where those kids would go if they weren't is a problem. And how we're going to address that with regard to state funding and so on. Because it's a big problem, I think, by looking at some of the numbers, that it's a growing concern for those little districts that are out there.
Thank you. Senator Monroe, last comment?
Well, there are very small school districts because of geography,
right,
and they pretty much have to be very small. There are other very small school districts like Riverdale that it's not geography. It's a matter of choice, and the way we fund those ought to be looked at.
Thank you. Well, Kate and Cindy, awesome presentation. We appreciate your time and your work and supporting another group of students in our system. Thank you. Anything else for the good of the order, Doug?
Madam Chair, Monday at 8:30, we'll hear two reports, more higher ed or transitional in nature. The first one is a recommendation by a work group that then went through the HEC Commission on accelerated learning. There's a $6.9 million special purpose appropriation to be distributed on that. And then the second report is on OSU's, well, in this case, it's the special or the statewide's extension experiment station and forest research, a report on how they spent their $14 million additional investment in those that came toward the end of session. And then the following Wednesday will be Umpqua Community College coming in and outlining their request that is in front of the legislature as a reaction to what happened at the end of, or at the beginning of October last year.
And I am planning to work with the big co-chairs to make sure that when we help Umpqua meet its security needs, that we also make those security things available to our other 17 community colleges.
Okay, I'll close it. Our presentation on online charter schools, and we are adjourned.
Thank you very much.
And we are adjourned.